20 days, one historic move, an unbelievable journey. Melania from the Amazon MGM Studios captures the one-of-a-kind transition into the White House, showcasing the planning, the pressure, and personal moments that come with stepping into the role of the First Lady for a second time. From logistical complexities to decisions made behind closed doors, the film brings you closer to Mrs. Trump and her family as they return to the nation's capital. See what history looks like before the doors officially open. Melania arrives exclusively in theaters January 30th, 2026.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there. This hour, I'll be joined by Rebecca Heinrichs. Man, there's a lot of international news to go over. And she's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, a real sense of what's happening over in Davos. Mike Tobin in studio, a premier senior correspondent here at Fox News, but he's got another message about his journey up to Mount Everest. He's a great athlete, and you see it here with great endurance, and it's proven in a show that's now on Fox Nation. It's called Everest, The Journey to the Top of the World with Mike Tobin. Mike actually didn't just cover it, he actually did it. Although if you go cover it, you're actually doing it, so I guess he's doing both. Mike, we're going to get to Mike in just a second. Two things are happening today. All the U.S. healthcare CEOs are going to be on Capitol Hill. They're going to get grilled by Democrats and Republicans. Will they have answers about the cost of healthcare? Few issues resonate more with Americans. Number two, Jack Smith on Capitol Hill today. And believe me, there's Republicans are angry and Democrats who wanted to see him go through and put President Trump in jail. If Republicans aren't ready to do that battle, he is. He's whatever you think of him, he's a very competent attorney, so he's going to defend his practices, some of which seem indefensible. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
After that woman was shot, I think, unfortunately, well, everything's unfortunate about it, right? But one of the real problems is now ICE are villains. And now people are looking at them like murderous military people that are on the streets of our city.
Well, that's what Joe Rogan thinks, but I think he's wrong. And if you are thinking that, it has a lot to do with your idiot mayor in Minnesota and your governor. Clashes with ICE not thawing in Minneapolis as they pick up the pace in Maine now. The story on fraud in Minnesota moves front and center. And also, fingers are beginning to point to the men and women in power. Yes, they're being investigated. I'll explain.
Number two.
2026 is in many ways is an election that will be defined as a referendum. 2028 is an election that will be a choice about how we're going to fight and build for the future.
Yep, campaigning like it's 2024. That's what Susie Weil says President Trump will be doing beginning in Iowa this week. We have the latest on 26 and 28. And you just heard Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, thinking he's a presidential candidate.
Number one.
It's not entirely clear to me how it would matter practically, much difference it would make between that and what we have now. We have extensive basing rights in Greenland under a treaty reached in 1951 through NATO.
So what changes? Massive news emerging from Davos. Normally a sleepy economics meeting between the rich and famous was dominated by President Trump. His first he quells the uproar over Greenland with a big deal. We don't know the details yet. Now he has a board of peace, plus Gavin Newsom and Al Gore embarrassing themselves in the backdrop. Somebody who doesn't embarrass themselves ever, especially on camera, is Mike Tobin. Mike, welcome back.
Good to see you, pal.
Why are you limping? What's with the crutches? What happened?
I broke my leg.
How'd you do it?
Walking the dog.
Really?
Just slipped on the ice. I did that dance you do when you slipped on the ice and it ended poorly.
So, and especially you're a gymnast, right? I mean, I should be the one breaking my leg on the ice.
That's how it happened. And the break is at the top of the fibula, and then I've got a specialist who keeps putting me back together. And he took one look at the x-ray and says, is your ankle hurt worse? And I said, yeah, it does. And there's all kinds of ankle damage, so they had to sink a plate and some screws in there.
Wow, and when did this happen?
Just before Christmas, and I had the surgery a week ago.
And did you know it was broken right away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My dog did.
He was jumping on me. He thought, hey, we're rolling on the ground now.
Right. And did you were able to get home? Or?
Yeah. I was. Actually, I was up on a mountain path, and I was able to self-rescue, limp my way down, and call my wife.
You even take your dog on the mountain?
Yeah, sure. He loves it up there.
All right. I want to talk about Mount Everest, but I also like to get your impression from Chicago. You're just fresh off covering ICE over in Chicago, and now you see the mayhem in Minneapolis and right. even in Maine now. So
I was there when Renee Good was shot, and I think I broke that story. I was the first one on the air with it.
So you were actually watching this whole thing
watching it at meltdown, if you will. And they started reaching conclusions right away. Immediately went to the conclusion that it was an unjustified shooting. And then everyone, you see all the video, and people reach their conclusions that they reach the conclusions they want.
Right.
And they, all the partisans.
What did you think?
Well, you see the car very clearly lunge toward that agent. And Jacob Frey
wanted... And you hear it now. Now you hear him get hit.
Right. And Jacob Frey wanted to minimize the injuries to the ICE agent. But when you hear that, so the car made contact. So yeah. He got hit by that car.
Right.
It's not his job to judge how hard he's going to get hit by that car.
But the organization of people who are harassing ICE, cutting them off, boxing them in, she was part of that. There's no doubt about it. She took training, right?
And if you go back to when Border Patrol was in Chicago, Superintendent Larry Snelling was telling people that someone is going to get shot if you keep making these aggressive maneuvers with their cars. So right. he's not the oracle. He just saw... something that was obvious.
And the one thing that, this is what Joe Rogan said, and you had a little bit in the very open, cut 43.
After that woman was shot, I think, unfortunately, well, everything's unfortunate about it, right? But one of the real problems is now ICE are villains. And now people are looking at them like murderous military people that are on the streets of our city, and they're masked up, which is also a problem, right? Yeah. Because if you get arrested by a cop, you're allowed to ask the cop, what is your name and badge number? And you could film that cop. If you get arrested by an ICE agent, you have no such right. They're wearing a mask. They don't have to tell you shit. That's a problem. That's a problem on our city streets, right? Because you could also pretend to be an ICE agent.
Oh, you could pretend to be a cop. So I don't know. Your thought about that point in terms of the sentiment? Do you think the sentiment is pervasive in these major cities that ICE are bad?
Well, the people who come out, they've already made their conclusion when they come out. And as it relates to the masks, I can't tell you how many protesters I've seen with masks on shouting at the agents to take your mask off. And the reason they cover their face is so no one figures out who they are and they don't have any consequence afterward. Yeah. Same motivation for the ICE agents. They get doxxed all the time. So that's been out in public for a long time.
Right. So how do you see this ending in Minneapolis, for example? For example, what is it like on the streets of Chicago now?
It has calmed down in Chicago. It still flares up from time to time. Immigration enforcement didn't leave Chicago, but certainly the Border Patrol guys, when they come in, they stir up a lot of controversy every time.
All right, so tell me about this special and on One Nation, on Fox Nation.
We're really proud of this, and it's unlike anything I've ever done at Fox News. I haven't done long format before. You know, the way you write, the way you deliver is all different, and the pictures really carry this thing. When you get up high, it's something, and obviously not all of you are going to go to Everest. And now you can see it, and you can see what it's like.
Why do you want to do it? Not so much the special, but actually the mission.
Why climb?
Yeah.
You know, I got to tell you, my dad checked out at 92 years old, and after he served in World War II, he raised 7 kids. He succeeded in business. He failed in business. And before he died, he told me, you know, it happens fast. And the things you want to do, the things you've been thinking about, you know, I'm almost 60 years old, do them. You're running out of time. Life happens fast.
Right. And that really resonated with you.
Yeah.
And so is this the first example of you taking on life this way?
No, I think I've always been doing it. Look at this job. I got in this job because I wanted the adventure.
You're in the middle of, every time we go to you, it's never typical, right? It's never like a magazine shoot and Spring Breakers. Yeah, it doesn't happen with Mike Tobin.
I like the adventure, but sometimes I feel like a wino drowning in Cabernet.
So here is Mike Tobin. You want to prepare this. You said you're preparing to go up with Adrian Ballinger.
Right.
So how did you, is there anything I should know before I roll the clip?
I don't know which clip you're going to roll, but.
Well, let's listen together then.
All right.
Cut 56.
So Alpenglow and I in 2012 developed what we call the Rapid Ascent System. We simulate altitude, reduced oxygen environments at home. And by people spending 6 to 8 weeks in those tents sleeping at night, we can reduce the length of an Everest expedition from 65 to 70 days to down to around 30 to 35 days.
Over time, the 8 hours or so that we spend sleeping in the tents allows our red blood cells to get used to the amount of oxygen that we'll be breathing here at altitude so that you can be more efficient and safe in the mountains.
It doesn't make it easier, but it makes it more attainable for more people who have busy lives.
Well, what that does, that there's a pump that feeds the tent, and it increases the nitrogen in the air and crowds out the oxygen and tricks your body to think that you're at altitude. So you start kicking out more red blood cells. And then when we arrive, we go pretty quickly up to 17,000 feet. And to give you an idea, the tallest Colorado peak is 14,000 feet. Wow. So we're higher than any place you can get in the lower 48, just starting the climb.
Are you pulling your, because I haven't had a chance to see it yet. I was on location yesterday. Are you going up a path, or are you actually doing things like where you're using your upper body and pulling yourself up cliffs?
There's a lot of vertical. Whenever you do a big mountain, there will be vertical obstacles. There's a big one is right at the beginning, the North Col. And if you go back, this is the route that George Mallory climbed, the guy who said, I'll climb Everest because it's there. And ultimately, he perished on the mountain. But that was his route. And the North Col, is you start out with a difficult problem. And the first, I think the second or third time that the Mallory team attempted it, they lost 19 guys on the North Col. And so that's almost pure vertical when you're going up the ice on the North Col.
I want you to hear more. Here's Mike Tobin and other climbers as they make the third step on the summit, to the summit, Cut 57.
Once I had cleared the second step, I knew the third step was not as difficult an obstacle. All the fear, all the anxiety that I had for a month laying in camp. Am I tough enough? Am I good enough? Is this going to work out? I looked at the summit cone and I said, I got this.
After we got to the last rocky part and you're just on the snow slope, it kind of started to hit me like, wow, this is happening.
Once I got above the third step and you could see the summit, I knew this was going to happen.
Right. I've dreamed of turning the corner and seeing the north face of Everest for 10 years now.
So you want to bring some color to that? Why did you think the third step is easier?
Yeah, the third step is easier. The second step, also when it goes back to the George Mallory team, Conrad Anker, a famous climber, thinks that the Mallory-Irvine team never made it past the second step. No one really knows where they disappeared on the mountain. But the second step is the hardest. It does have ladders in there now. And once I was over, I've been reading about this since before I was a reporter. And so I knew about all the obstacles. And once I cleared the second step, that's when I turned to Piso Sherpa. And I said something too vulgar for your radio show, but it meant I got it.
Who's with you?
I was with just Piso Sherpa at that point. He and I kind of broke ahead of the other climbers.
And who's your shooter?
The shooter ran. There was a collection of guys on the mountain, particularly a guy named Griffin Mims shot a lot of what you see in this special.
While you're climbing, how much of you is as a producer, a reporter, and how much of you is just flat-out climber? Are you thinking to yourself, okay, I'm going to need a shot here. I'm going to need this shot. Are you thinking like that, or are you just thinking about doing the mountain?
I was thinking about that, but there's a lot of time when it's all you can do is climb.
Right.
So it's unfortunate because I do think that some of the best shots were missed. But what are you going to do?
Because your shooter has to climb, too.
Right.
Right.
Griffin shot a lot. A guy named Griffin Mims, who works for Alpenglow, he shot a lot of it. The guys on the team shot a lot of it. One guy named Tico Morales had his phone out on summit day quite a bit. And the pictures are really dramatic.
Right. And how do you feel now having done it?
You know, I think I'm still the same guy.
Right.
You talk with some athletes who win a championship and they say, yeah, all right, now it's Tuesday. Let's move forward. What's next?
Yeah, that's how you feel. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe you see the show, you'll feel different.
Yeah, and I hope I inspire some other people. I hope, certainly hope to encourage people to support their veterans organizations, Mission 22 and a Chicago organization called Light the Line, supporting wellness of first responders. That sort of evolved during the climb, but I'd really like to make sure that the stunt I did on top of the mountain isn't hollow.
Got it. I want to find out more about that in a second. You have some more time?
You bet.
All right. A couple more minutes with Mike Tobin before we go. And the bottom of the hour, we talk about what the president's doing overseas. He's already had his, his mission of peace. His peace council has been named. We're a lot of them there. 36 were signed on and 20 showed up in person. What it means for the UN, the reaction with no European allies involved yet. We'll talk about that as well as the Greenland deal. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show, a huge, huge news day.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fox News is a big part of who I am, so I hold the flag up. Take a photo moment at that point.
On the summit, Mike did 22 push-ups in recognition of the number of veteran suicides reported every day.
Really what I wanted to communicate is that we are so deep in the death zone. I'd really like to reach a troubled first responder or veteran and just communicate the message that someone cares enough to take the time to do that. And so that's what the 22 push-ups were all about.
That is so cool. And that's part of the foundation that you're raising money for, right?
Right. Well, raising money now for Mission 22.
Yeah.
And there's a Chicago organization called Light the Line, which was dedicated to the memory of Ella French, a Chicago police officer killed in the line of duty. And we did the premiere the other night in Chicago, and Carlos Yanez showed up. And he was with Ella French the night she was killed and shot, I think, four times. One of the bullets went through his eye, and wow, he survived. And he's now dedicated himself to the wellness of his fellow officers. And a wonderful woman named Betsy Shepherd put that whole event together.
So, Mike, you get to the summit and you did 20, you get to the top and you do 22 push-ups right there. But can you tell me the feeling you had?
The feeling I had was that I overcommitted. I started doing the push-ups. I don't know if I can make 22.
Really?
But, yeah, they weren't, maybe they weren't the tidiest push-ups you ever see, but I got all 22. And the world record, I found out later, is 31.
So what was it like going up with an expert like Adrian?
It's kind of comforting, you know, when you're with a guy who removes some of the doubts. He's climbed it without oxygen. Only about 400 people have ever climbed Everest without oxygen, and 200 of them are Sherpa. And so Adrian he's an expert. He knows the mountain. So working with someone like him and the pre-acclimatization removes some of the doubt. You still think you're going to die most of the time. You look at camp and you think, that's it, tomorrow I'm dying.
Right. Yeah. You came across a body.
About four.
Four bodies.
On the way to the summit. And they still can't get... They're using drones now to get some of the bodies that are up there, but it's still too much. And having been up there, I understand there's no way you could go up there.
Do they know who they are? Their families?
They know who some of them are. And a lot of them because they know that this person disappeared on the climb. The guy who's at the second step is known as Green Boots. And they're unraveling the mystery of who he is. They think he was an Indian climber who disappeared on Summit Day back in the 1996 disaster.
So can you picture what it was like to be the first one to climb Mount Everest?
That would be something. It's different, though, because the amount of doubt you have on a route that's already been climbed, if you haven't climbed it before, if no one's climbed it before, you don't really know what's ahead of you.
Yeah.
So those guys, I'll never match that kind of courage.
So I want to talk about Chicago before we go. I did not know this. I mean, we had the same thing with the Jets and Giants. They're going to move. They're going to sell. New England Patriots going to move to Connecticut. It's to get a better deal, perhaps.
Sure.
But do you think the Bears, there's a chance the Bears might be leaving Chicago?
You know, I don't have evidence to support this, but I say, no way. It's never going to happen. They're not going to be the Gary Bears.
Right.
But Governor Braun, right away, as soon as he saw a chink in the armor, said, come on, come to Indiana. Those guys, a professional sports team brings a host of jobs with them.
Yeah.
Down to the restaurants, to the parking guys. And, you know, and you think about the mayor of Chicago saying that he wants to support minorities and wants to support poor people. Well, what's the one thing a poor guy needs? It's a job.
Yeah. I know.
Fight for those jobs.
So he says, I don't want to put money into a stadium. But usually cooperation, there's a cooperative situation.
You strike a deal.
Right.
They talk about moving to Arlington, which is a suburb of Chicago. It's not going to happen. I just believe it's not going to happen. They're the Chicago Bears. And they had a great season, by the way.
Unbelievable. And what a quarterback. I don't know if there's anybody with a more promising future than Caleb Williams.
It's awesome. And, you know, you talk about people who have heart attacks shoveling snow.
Not yet. Mike Tobin, get better quick. Congratulations.
Thanks, pal.
Check out his Fox Nation special right now.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition.
But it's clear that we are reaching a time of instability, of imbalances.
You have the choice between your self-respect. Huh? Being a happy vessel is one thing. Being a miserable slave is something else.
It is time to seize this opportunity and build a new independent Europe.
So these are some of the critics that are coming out after the President of the United States made it clear that he wants a deal or wants to take Greenland. The Canadian Prime Minister, the French Emmanuel Macron, the Belgian Prime Minister was weighing in. The EU Commissioner, Ursula van Leyen, says it is time to look to seize the opportunity to hold us independent Europe. Good luck with that. And now what they're doing, they don't want to be independent Europe. They're going to China. The chancellor of Germany is going to go visit China. EU is allowing this this enormous embassy, which is going to be just a spy hub in the middle of London, while giving away Diego Garcia, which will give the influence to China. And then you have the Canadian prime minister acting like a tough guy going over to China, selling out his industry, his manufacturing, and his car business. Rebecca Heinrich, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and joins us now. Hey, Rebecca, I thought it was a huge overreaction by Europe, who got bent out of shape over the president's aggression towards Greenland. What is your take?
Hi, Brian. Well, good to be here. Yeah, I think that all of those clips that you just aired really demonstrate, you know, some of the worst of the European responses. If your complaint is, you know, I don't like the president of the United States making threats towards an ally, okay, that's point well taken. We get that. But then to turn around and say that therefore you're going to invest in the Chinese Communist Party, I mean, that is not a country that's going to respect sovereignty, the rule of law, pluralism, the freedom of the human person, the dignity of the human person. And so I think that, you know, a lot of overreaction kind of reminds me of the first Trump administration, when you had Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, act like a tough girl and act like, you know, Europe is going to stand up to the United States. There were some bright spots, though, Brian. The chancellor of Germany this time, Merz, actually said that he's got to start to make some changes. He's heard the United States and he's going to do things that are better. For instance, he's not going to abandon nuclear energy, which is something that Angela Merkel did. So I think you're going to have some course correction. You did have Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, defending President Trump. So I think we're just going to have some negotiations back and forth and hopefully kind of appeal to the better angels of some of the better Europeans.
Yeah, I agree. Here's for another critic, the Norwegian Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, cut 14.
No, but I'm very explicit that I find that unacceptable, you know, to say that I have to have peace of another country's land. You know, we are democracies, we are allies in NATO. But I think the idea of declaring that, you know, I need a piece of land of another country just like that, we have to respond very clearly on that.
So, you know, the whole thing is he's saying the president made it clear. He's like, one way or another, I'm going to get Greenland. They didn't like that. While he's flying over, could have probably got to it quicker, but they had an electrical problem. They had to turn back with Air Force One, switch planes. So more people got up and more people spoke out. So Davos used to be a sleepy conference for rich and famous people. This is all about President Trump.
It is. It's all about President Trump. I mean, look, he's flexing American strength and American power. He's trying to use our influence to shore up the strength and security of the West. I really appreciate it. I mean, President Trump, he started off on this Greenland gambit, you know, a little bit more, I mean, more hostile towards NATO in his rhetoric. He moved, Brian. He moved as things, you know, really started to churn in negotiations, whenever he saw some pushback from members of Congress, et cetera, and he was willing to negotiate. You've already seen now President Trump in his Davos speech, he moved his rhetoric to something that's like, look, the United States needs to defend Greenland and the Arctic, not just for our own security, but the security of the West. No other country can do this. If you want to come alongside us, please do. But we have to box out the Chinese and the Russians. And so I think we're in a much better position. And if Europeans would have been just a little bit more patient, and some of them were. Some of them were a little bit more patient. You saw the Italian Prime Minister Meloni was more patient and was willing to cooperate with President Trump. And that's where you had a lot more progress, I think.
I mean, what they're not used to doing, they're used to going through, and Rebecca, this is your world, diplomacy. There's a way to say it. Look at subtlety in the language, and there might be a distancing. You know, we're used to looking for things by body language. The president just says exactly what he's thinking. He tells you before, and then he goes and meets with people. He tells you after. If you give him a text that's friendly and you go in public and rip him, he will publish your text. We're not used to any. We will never probably see anything like this again.
That's right. And the other thing that's very different that I don't understand why people can't learn this about President Trump is he's not defaulting to the bureaucracy to work out the diplomacy. He does it at the highest level. So if these countries think that they're going to send some low-level undersecretary, deputy undersecretary to figure it out privately, that is just not the way President Trump does business. He really is the chief executive of the United States of America, and you got to deal directly with him.
So let's talk about his Bureau of Peace that he's put together, the Board of Peace, I should say, where he's the chairman. Among the countries that have signed up, Argentina, Belarus, Morocco, Vietnam, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kosovo, Paraguay, Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, and I can go on. And the people that have not been there, pretty much no NATO people outside Turkey. You have Germany's not there, UK's not there, France is not there, Norway, Sweden is not there. I'm not sure if Belgium's there. No, they're not. They're not there. Indonesia's there. So your thought about what the approach is, this is bigger than Gaza, and it wants to be permanent, and the president's leading it. So your thoughts about this?
Well, I think it's still too early to tell. I mean, this is another one of those things where President Trump kind of thinks outside the box. Clearly, this is a shot across the bow of the United Nations, which has been totally unable to carry out this vision of global peace. And remember, the United Nations is really the stepchild of the League of Nations, which was a failure as well, to try to stop the world wars and to try to prevent world war again after the wars. And so, you know, what President Trump has demonstrated, I think, now in two terms, well, one term and 1 year of his second term, is that peace is really had by the strength of countries, the strength of the United States. It's not actually going to be negotiated by boards or by United Nations. So it is interesting that he's putting this board of peace, or, you know, whatever he's calling it, kind of forward. It does seem to me as he's chipping away at the United Nations. How long it'll last, I don't know. I think that the fact that, you know, NATO countries are refusing to play ball is another, you know, demonstration of sort of obstinance against President Trump.
So, Rebecca, here's an example. It's not like, okay, the UN, if they're trying to bring peace to these various regions, you go, well, they're ineffective. Are they trying? Have you seen any shuttle diplomacy between Russia, Vladimir Putin, who's on this National Security, the Security Council, and Zelensky? Have you seen any shuttle diplomacy with Pakistan and India? Have you seen any them going back and forth with Prime Minister Netanyahu and who's ever running Gaza? No, but you saw UNRWA, a division of the UN, working with Hamas, and some of which might have been on the October 7th invasion into Israel. So I don't see them doing anything.
That's right. No, the UN has basically, so the purpose of the UN originally was supposed, from an American perspective, which is the perspective I care about the most, if we got in there in the UN and over the last, you know, 40, 50 years, threw our elbows around and made sure that we were using it for our own purposes and for the defense of the West, it'd be one thing. But because Americans have failed to do that, you have the Chinese using the UN. You have the Iranians using the UN. You have all these countries using the UN for their purposes against U.S. interests, which, of course, is not for peace. Their interests are not for peace. So that's exactly right. You have these multilateral institutions that have simply been corrupted. I mean, the Chinese throw their weight around for their own purposes. They block what the United States is trying to do to defend the Israelis, to block, you know, I mean, you even have China and Russia using the UN to block sanctions against North Korea. So, I mean, people keep talking about how great the UN is, but the UN has been essentially used to block U.S. interests and to block efforts for global peace and stability.
So the Syria situation, I want to go to that, and Iran. President says Iran's willing to talk. I don't know if he means that or not. But what would be there to talk to Iran about? They keep threatening the lives of the President of the United States. They blame Israel and the U.S. for the unrest in their country when they know it's squarely on their shoulders. They underreported how many deaths. They said over 2,000. It's well over 15,000. They shot in cold blood in their streets. This whole Iranian government has to be rattled to the core.
Yeah, I don't think that there's going to be any reform of the current Iranian government under the Ayatollah, Brian. And you know, as the president sort of, or his deputies, you saw Witkoff saying that maybe we can talk. You know, whenever there is that kind of rhetoric being used by our government, you also see U.S. forces moving into the region. So there's there's some forces moving from the Indo-Pacific theater sort of into the CENTCOM theater even now. And so I don't know if the president is still considering military force against the regime. He drew that red line, Brian, as you've talked about a lot, about the, you know, saying that the Iranian government regime couldn't kill protesters, and they have. And the Ayatollah continues to threaten President Trump. He's on X running his mouth, threatening President Trump as recently as the last couple of days. And so I don't think this is over yet. I don't think there's any negotiating to be had with the current Ayatollah. I do think it's time for a different regime in place and to let the Iranian people decide their future.
Rebecca, what can you make of what's going on in Syria? They're trying to reclaim all their territory and push the Kurds out. Turkey loves them pushing the Kurds out. The Kurds are probably most loyal people in the region. They're great fighters. Now they're getting hit by Iran. And Iran looks at them as a problem. I think they could basically, pound for pound, they would crush any type of fighting force Iran could put together. What is their future like, and how do you feel about ISIS, the ISIS detention center moving to Iraq?
Well, that's terrible. I mean, you saw some evidence that this ISIS detention center might, you know, some of these people might be released, et cetera. I mean, Syria is going to constantly be a challenge for the United States. I support the Trump administration's effort to try to work with the new government in Syria because, you know, under Bashar al-Assad, that was a pro-Iranian proxy in the region. And I understand people's concerns. Senator Lindsey Graham has been concerned that, listen, like this guy who's running Syria now, I mean, he was a member of a terrorist organization just a couple of days ago. So, you know, we have to be really careful as we watch this. I'm very concerned, as you are, about the Kurds. As you said, you know, the Kurds have been loyal and fighting alongside, those who want a better future and don't want to be governed by the Islamist regimes in the area. And so it's just going to take a lot of effort. I still am hoping and am confident that the United States can use our diplomacy and our pressure against the Syrian government to make sure they don't do really stupid things that run against our interests, especially when it comes to the Kurds.
I guess. What do you think we need in terms of assets for us to be able to hit Iran? You know, the president of the United States, he takes his time. He thinks about it. He gives talks a chance. And when they don't pan out, he does take action. And now you have the U.S. We have an aircraft carrier, I believe, that's arrived.
Yeah. So here's a couple other things of why I've actually, although I'm eager and getting impatient for the U.S. to make good on President's red line that he drew and to enforce it in some way. But I also appreciate that he's taking his time. President Trump is almost impervious to this, you know, this
pressure.
The crowd pressuring to do that. He just moves at his own pace. And I do think there's some things that needed to happen first before the U.S. could do anything. We had to evacuate American and ally personnel. That takes time. I also heard from some incredible analysts that the Israelis wanted to collect some intelligence on how the Iran regime would react if they thought a threat was coming. So it does make sense to me that the U.S. may head fake a threat, an attack. You allow the Israelis to collect on what the Iran regime does whenever we say that, so that whenever we do strike, we can get more targets. And the other thing is we needed to get assets into the region. We have had a lot of assets into different theaters, and so we need to move them in and get them in place. So I think all that makes sense for getting sort of our ducks in a row before we do strikes. Real quick, we can do very limited strikes against IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Those are the folks that are protecting the Ayatollah and the mullahs. We can do strikes against them. We can do big cyber attacks in conjunction with that to help the Iranian people and stop the Iran regime from their crackdown and their blackouts. We can do much more massive strikes. We can go after regime heads. We can go after ballistic missile forces, which the Chinese have been sending component parts to help the Iran regime build up their ballistic missile force. So we have a lot of options. The Iran regime is very weak, so I'm not as worried about retaliatory measures against the United States, which the Iran regime has been threatening. So I think the president's got a lot of good options before him.
Yeah, absolutely. Rebecca, I tell you what, for someone like you in foreign policy, everything went on hyperspeed. Usually it takes forever. You analyze, there's a meeting, there's a summit. Everything's going at once. And then the president made statements to the Wall Street Journal, picked up by the New York Post, that he wants Cuba to flip, flip governments by the end of the year and do something that even John F. Kennedy wasn't able to do. Raul Castro, I think, is in his 90s, technically running the country, and which is just an absolute abomination. Do you think he's got a shot at doing that?
I think he does. And I want to put foot stomp something about the speed, too. You talked about how fast everything's going. You know, I've been doing foreign policy a long time. And one of the things that people kind of always push back on, the experts, is that, you know, a president of the United States only has one or two things he can get done in a term. And you've got all this domestic pressure, too. He's got to handle his domestic needs. President Trump is, it's just this empirically true. He has been able to do necessary things domestically, crack down on illegal immigration, get the border under control, do deportations of those who are criminal, illegal aliens, while he's conducting very muscular foreign policy. He's doing it at the same time. And so in addition to doing multiple theaters, I mean, we're talking a lot about our hemisphere.
Yeah.
And it is true, President Trump is focusing on our hemisphere, but he's not neglecting far away lands either. He still cares about the Middle East. He still cares about the European theater, and he still cares about the Pacific theater. And so, yes, I do think that the president has got 3 years left, and I think we're still going to see some pretty big moves, even in our own hemisphere.
All right, Rebecca, thanks so much. Fascinating time. Great perspective with all your experience. She is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Rebecca Heinrichs, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
We'll come back with some calls in just a moment. Don't move.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. Just a quick announcement. You know, coming up, I can't believe it's almost here, Valentine's Day, a chance to go to Fort Myers, Florida, big Fox market. Hope to see everyone in person. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. It's going to be streamed on Fox Nation History, Liberty, and Laughs on stage. About 2.5-3 hours. Nobody leaves and says, wow, that was worse than I thought. Everybody can't believe what we put together because this has been evolving over the last 3-4 years. And you're going to get fun, entertainment. Pat O'Rourke and Rick Fatcher will be on there, and we're going to have special guests and unbelievable perspective in year 250 of our country's history. Hope to see everyone in person. Also, Reno, Nevada, we have a great Las Vegas affiliate. Hopefully, those people in Las Vegas will tell the people in Reno and go over there. That'll be May 30th, and that'll be great. And hope to see everyone there in person. And don't forget, One Nation, Sunday at 10 p.m. 10 p.m., you'll see a great roster of guests, including Senator John Cornyn's going to be on with us, and Steve Mosher. If there's a better expert on China and what they're up to in our own region, I have not met them yet, and Carly Shimkus is also going to be with us, too. So that's all coming up Sunday at 10 o'clock. Right here. Meanwhile, within this show, we're going to be covering the latest with Jack Smith testifying Capitol Hill, insurance CEOs testifying Capitol Hill, and we're going to get to the bottom and talk more about the fraud that's not only rampant in Minneapolis, but can you say Maine, Washington State, and especially California? We're on top of it all. Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming in from Midtown Manhattan. Back in action today. And man, there is a lot of action. And I can't cover it all, but I'll say this. I love the fact that the Border Patrol and ICE is doing something I've been waiting for them to do on national television every day. I want you to show me the criminals you're picking up off the streets. I'm seeing this story this morning. Oh, a man and his 5-year-old were picked up in the driveway. All right. Why? What do they do? Do you want to fill in the blanks there? We're watching these mayors come out and say these things that ICE is just grabbing moms and dads. Criminals broke the law, came across the border illegally, brought their kids with them, waited on our social justice system. We told them $10,000 you get to leave on your own. Guarantee you, these people have criminal records. It's not my fault. Criminals have 5-year-olds. And if you're driving drunk and you got kids in the back of the car, it's going to be traumatic, but you're going to jail. They're going to watch their father or mother go to jail. That's just the way it is. And those kids are going to have to stay in the police station until other family members come to pick them up. It is traumatic, but ultimately it's the responsibility of the parent, not the fault of ICE. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
After that woman was shot, I think, unfortunately, well, everything's unfortunate about it, right? But One of the real problems is now ICE are villains. And now people are looking at them like murderous military people that are on the streets of our city.
There you go. Clashes with ice not thawing in Minneapolis and in Maine as they pick up the pace. The story on fraud in Minnesota moves front and center, and fingers begin to point at the men and women in power. I'll explain.
Number two.
2026 is in many ways is an election that will be defined as a referendum. 2028 is an election that will be a choice about how we're going to fight and build for the future.
Okay, that was generic, but Rahm Emanuel, for the most part, wants to talk about education, getting it back. Really? You've been doing so great with it. The anti-Americanism, the horrible grades, the diminishing scores, fantastic. Don't let any SATs count. Campaigning like it's 2024. That's what Susie Wiles says President Trump will be doing beginning in Iowa this week. No more foreign trips. He says I have the latest on the 26 race and the 28 race, the left and the right.
Number one.
It's not entirely clear to me how it would matter practically, much difference it would make between that and what we have now. We have extensive basing rights in Greenland under a treaty reached in 1951 through NATO.
That is Britt Hume on Where We Go From Greenland. Massive news emerging from Davos. Normally a sleepy economics meeting between the rich, the famous, and the rich and the famous. It's dominated by President Trump. He first has to quell the uproar over Greenland. He's got a deal, at least the framework of one. And then he named the Board of Peace. Meanwhile, Gavin Newsom and Al Gore embarrassing themselves in the backdrop. It's no doubt about it. So Gavin Newsom shows up. I don't see anything memorable about his speech. Was complaining they wasn't able to go to an American party that, as an American governor, he thinks he should have gone to. But why would you? You sit there ripping the President of the United States overseas an international summit. Just stay home. If you want to win, govern California. But you don't govern California. Number two. Al Gore hemming and hawing at Mark Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, presser. What are you doing? Nobody cares what you think, Al Gore. You made $1 billion off this green wave. Told us Earth had a fever and was going to burn. Everything you said, nothing has come true. If Europe listened, green went crazy, Paris summit went nuts, people signing proclamations that Russia and China would never sign on to. They make the batteries to China, they make the solar panels to China, but they build coal plants and wind. And we watched all this happen. Economies being hurt severely. And now Al Gore shows up like he's a hero. Yeah, maybe to them he's a hero. But show some decorum. Hemming and hawing and heckling an American official. I mean, how low can you go? I thought he was from a period where things were somewhat civil outside the Monica Lewinsky investigation. But the path has been set here at Davos because the President of the United States said he wanted to grab Greenland. Why? National security, rare earth, it's right near us. Strategically, you have no business being here. And we heard all that. We watched the market crash. President came over, cut a deal. It looks like we're going to start expanding our bases and claim the land that we're building it on and start land basing a lot of the missile defense system that's part of the Golden Dome. I think that'll be a big positive. I do not know the details yet. Here's the president, cut one.
But every NATO ally has an obligation to be able to defend their own territory. And the fact is, no nation or group of nations is in any position to be able to secure Greenland other than the United States. Greenland is a vast, almost entirely uninhabited and undeveloped territory. It's sitting undefended in a key strategic location between the United States, Russia, and China. It's the United States alone that can protect this giant mass of land, this giant piece of ice, develop it and improve it and make it so that it's good for Europe and safe for Europe and good for us.
But the market didn't like it. Our allies are going to rally against us, and China and Russia rejoice at the fracture. But it's not a fracture. It's an eruption. It's an eruption because they still don't understand Trump. It's an eruption because Davos is taking place in Europe, and they got to act tough in front of their people. But they haven't built up their defense. They're overrun with social services obligations. All their economies are struggling. The UK, with this horrible leadership led by Keir Starmer, has now acquiesced on Diego Garcia, a key military outlet for America, and given it basically to the people there who are basically controlled by China. And then they let this mega embassy, which is going to be a big spy station, built right in London, that everybody was pushing back against, but not him. Everyone's kissing up to China now because they don't think we are the people to go with. Now, I want you to hear some of the negativity coming out of here. And don't tell me this doesn't get you angry. Mark Carney, a liberal leader of Canada, coming out, speaking out after going to China and giving away his cars, domestic car industry and manufacturing, doing a deal with a country that was scooping up Canadians off the street and holding them prisoners for no reason. Listen to him and Macron yesterday. Cut 12.
But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited.
We do prefer respect to bullies. We do prefer science to plotism. And we do prefer rule of law to brutality.
Argue the middle powers must act together because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
Right now we are talking about a situation about the world order. Respect for territorial integrity, respect for international law.
But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination.
Now, this is a country that's economy is backwards, that has almost no military, no functioning submarines, very few ships. They have a military where they spend 1.6% of their military. We watch their back and have to pour our money. You know how much more money we would have for all of us if we didn't have to spend almost $1 trillion on a military that defends places like Canada? You know who gets it? The NATO General Secretary, Mark Rutte. Cut 9.
Last year, under his leadership, NATO collectively reached that famous 2%, which we agreed 10 years ago. I asked the room, I said, big countries like Spain and Italy and Belgium and Canada reaching that 2%, would it have ever happened if President Trump would not have been reelected? No. And then in June in The Hague, we agreed on this 5% defense spending, including the 3.5% on core defense, equalizing with the US. Would that ever have happened if President Trump would not have been reelected as President 47 of the United States? Absolutely not. And now today, this agreement on working collectively on this deal getting done on the Arctic region, I think we can really commend him for taking that leadership role. He is the leader of the free world. He is the leader of the most powerful nation on earth, the biggest ally in NATO.
Yes, I like the pushback there. He's unorthodox, but Mark Rutte gets him, like Stoltenberg understands him, because they have the same objective. Build up NATO, push back against Russia. All right, when we come back, we change gears. We talk about the fastest, most exciting sport in the country that's signing up to do another year on Fox Nation. Eric Bischoff will be in studio. Chad Bronstein will be here. Izzy Martinez, all who found Real American Freestyle, RAF. Don't move.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All the wrestling fans watching live around the world on Fox Nation, it's about to go.
And Kobe Covington, people, he started as a wrestler, but he made his name in the UFC, and then he went back, and then he wins again after losing his initial bout. That is all part of Real American Freestyle. And Eric Bischoff is here. He's the chief media officer. And Chad Bronstein's here, co-founder and CEO of Real American Freestyle. And they have some good news to announce. They've got to be back for another year on Fox Nation after getting off to just a tremendous start. Congratulations, guys. Chad, it must be a great feeling to get how many events now? Four under your belt?
So we've gotten five.
Five under
your belt.
We're
coming on six.
Wow.
And, yeah, we're with Fox for almost 20 shows. It'll be 20 shows, which is so we're moving month to month. Every single month we have an event.
Right. And what have you found, Eric, in putting this together with the fans? What's been the reaction, and who is in the audience? Not watching, but like actually in the arenas.
That's one of the things I'm most excited about, because when you watch our show, you'll see such a great balance in the composition of that audience. A lot of kids, a lot of teens, a lot of preteens, and of course their parents and fans of wrestling. So we've got a great audience mix and composition. And I think the thing that I take away more than anything is just the enthusiasm from the wrestling community.
Right.
Because now they're seeing this sport that they've grown up with, that they love, they're committed to, and they're seeing it presented in a way that they never have before.
So, Chad, the amazing thing is you're doing something, you and Eric and Izzy, that people say, well, wrestling's a great sport, but it doesn't have marketability. You can't go pro with that. Who's going to pay to watch this? Number one, you didn't make it a team. You made it an individual, which is so smart. And number two is, what do you tell to those critics that said wrestling doesn't have a professional future?
Well, I think me, Eric, and Izzy are competitive in a good way. And so we tell them that, you know, like I say, you know, you may hate it on in the beginning, but if you want to grow the sport and make it a massive sport, then you should join and with everyone else that loves the sport. Because I think what we've done is we've changed the trajectory for kids like Eric's mentioning and everybody else in the sport, and gave a big stage to the best athletes in the world.
Who are the wrestlers you signed? How many have you signed, Eric?
I thought I heard Izzy say this morning we're upwards of about 140, 150.
We signed 150 athletes. And without them, we wouldn't be here. They took a shot at this in the beginning, but we have superstars from the United States, and we just signed the number one wrestler in Russia, Sajulayev.
Right. So you deal with other countries.
Yes. And what's interesting, Brian, is since we've started this on our Instagram account, we get hit up by every country. Recently, we just got hit up by the head of Mongolia, who reached out to us and said, hey, we have these Olympic gold medals. We want them to be a part of RAF. So RAF, yes, started in the U.S., but now it's moving international.
Wow. So you got this card, the latest card, it's RAF 6. It takes place February 28th at the Mullet Arena on the campus of Arizona State University. You got lightweight, featherweight, middle, and two middleweight bouts, and then a women's strawweight bout.
Yeah, I think on that card, you know what's really cool is that Henry Cejudo is coming back. He's a two-time UFC champion and the youngest Olympic gold medalist, going up against Uriah Faber, also who is an MMA star and also was a wrestler. So that's going to be the main event in Arizona.
Right. And both of you, you've been on camera too, and you're very comfortable on camera too, Eric. When you put together this presentation, what struck me is your week one should have been like a week 20. It's like as if you've done this before. Does it feel like something you would have done with WWE, a different type of wrestling, which is it's fun. This is real.
I think one of the reasons I'm sitting here with you guys this morning is because I bring 30 plus years of television production experience from the world of professional wrestling, as we knew it, WWE. And I brought those elements into the sport of freestyle wrestling. And I think it's that presentation that's getting us where we're getting to. But a lot of the guys that are part of our production crew are people that I've worked with for 15 or 20 years.
What's been the reaction in the sports community? For example, I notice UFC guys are going in. If Dana White wasn't supportive, he would say, hey, you're under contract with me. I can't go to RAF and get hurt. But he seems to be rooting for you.
Yeah, I think, we've talked to the UFC, and I think for them, it's like we're additive, right? We're giving a platform for athletes to stay competitive. We're not competitive with the WWE. We're not competitive with the UFC. So it's beneficiary for everybody, because we're all, when they're on our stage, their brand continues, right? And so I think for them, they look at us as an additive approach. Like there's no competition here. We're not an MMA organization. We're family-friendly combat.
So the thing is, there's nothing more valuable in today's event. People don't know where we're heading in television, cable, streaming. If you could do, the only thing I hear is if you have sports, that's the one thing I guarantee you, people will find you. You put football on Amazon, we'll find you on Amazon. So to create a sports property that's actually sought after and doing the way you've done, Eric, what has it been like within the sports community? How are they looking at you guys?
I think they're looking at us as a legitimate contender in terms of having a permanent place in the combat sports arena, because people are seeing now that we can make freestyle and wrestling entertaining and fun to watch. And it's not just what we see on TV. If you go to our shows, you see, because we have downtime, we're transitioning between matches and so forth. There's live entertainment going on in between matches. We keep the crowd energized and excited about the product from the time they walk in the door till the time they get into the parking lot. And I think that's the key to our success, is keeping it entertaining.
I think to add to that, too, is like Eric said, mentioned earlier, our audience is heavy kids, right? Just all the youth clubs, you grew up knowing wrestlers.
Yeah.
They're fanatical, right? So you have to make sure you're creating that environment for them. We also have a fan zone, which is really cool. Like, you know, Gavin and Lauren actually came to the fan zone and saw it, but they had 1,000 kids.
Those are two Fox Nation executives.
Yes, and they took a shot with us, along with you. I always give credit to where it's deserved, but we wouldn't be sitting here. But the fan zone shows our that the audience, there's 1,000 kids that come 4 hours before, and they get to do meet and greets with athletes. And I think what's really cool about wrestling is wrestlers are super humble.
Right, here's the other thing. You walk into a Major League Baseball locker room, they all want you to go. Almost 90% of them don't want you to be there. It's NFL, same thing. But when you walk into wrestlers who have the same caliber athlete in their sport, they thank you for showing up. I also found that with women's sports. You walk into Major League Lacrosse locker rooms, we got the best in the world. But they're not treated like that. So it's kind of good to be in a media environment where they're glad you're there. And you told that to your guys and your women.
Yeah, you know what? It doesn't matter if you're a wrestler, even the UFC stars like a Colby Covington or a Michael Chandler coming in there, they're doing the same thing everyone else does. We have an hour and a half with kids, and so they do that before they compete.
You have a show coming out too. So not only do you have events, you have a show coming out on Fox Nation?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
And it is about?
It's how we kind of, how we built this, the story behind it, and then the best takedowns of our first five events.
Nice. And we're working on six. Where do you get tickets?
You get tickets on, you can get them on our site, or you can go on Ticketmaster.
Fantastic. And then the next one will be, of course, February 28th at the campus of Arizona State University, RAF 6. It's so good to see you guys do well. Two nicer people. I'm glad you'd never meet. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We've had two really qualified female candidates. One who was First Lady, Secretary of State, well-educated, you know. My husband beat her, right? People were more comfortable with him as a newcomer, right? And now we just had the former vice president. You know, we've had qualified women, and they just, you know, again, if they're not perfect and they don't cross every T and dot every I, there's a falling shortness that is happening.
So that was Michelle Obama on a podcast, and she's just trying to defend her statement that Gretchen Whitmer, and I don't know any woman that agrees with her. Maybe Hillary Clinton will use that as an excuse people to want to elect a woman. But Kamala Harris, I know for a fact that Michelle Obama thought nothing of Kamala Harris, knew she was a terrible candidate, as did her husband. It's been in two separate books, and she did not one thing for her. And people evidently like Michelle Obama. I don't know why she's so popular and sells so many magazine covers reportedly or books. But she's still holding and trying to defend her statement that America's not ready to elect a woman. That is thoroughly, 100% wrong. And I don't even think you could say it's harder for a woman. Josh Krasshauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Josh, I know there's bigger stories in the country than this, but I just wanted you to comment on it.
Yeah, look, I'm befuddled by it too, Brian, that Kamala Harris, I think objectively at this point, was a very subpar candidate. And because of the Democratic Party's insistence on playing identity politics, they've not fully grappled with the fact that she should not be running again for president, that she, frankly, had her turn. She badly underperformed most Democrats running for national office. And her politics were never able to moderate to the point where they reflected kind of the average majority of Americans. So, you know, the fact that and look, there are plenty of women running for in swing states and running for office that get elected. I mean, you saw in Virginia, New Jersey, you just elected two Democratic women governors. So, I mean, the notion that Kamala Harris and people just defending her can't take responsibility for her inadequacies as a candidate, her decision to pick Kim Walls as her running mate. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, we could go on all day talking about all the mistakes she's made in her political career. But the fact that they can't take responsibility for her record and have to play the identity game. And that is the Democratic Party's, frankly, the biggest problem, that they play identity politics at the expense of substance and actual policy.
Right. I mean, just in telling you the truth, if you want to get away from the people that might be sexist or racist, stop bringing it up. Just focus on the issues. Let those people wither in the distance. Don't give them front and center or a reason to think that they're winning if those people do exist. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who I'm sure is running for president, said this. Cut 25.
I love Michelle Obama, so the last thing I want to do is disagree with her. But, you know, I think America is ready for a woman president. You know, the question comes down to a choice between two people. And what we saw in this last election, while Kamala Harris didn't beat President Trump, we saw women get elected across the country.
Yes, you just had a governor, two governor, female governors, one in Virginia, one in New Jersey, who, by the way, a lot of problems with their candidacy. People weren't saying, well, I don't want to elect a woman, so I'm not going to give her a shot. They took the flawed candidates, especially the one in New Jersey, and said, I'm voting for him against this thing called a man.
Well, Brian, here's the problem. I mean, I don't know if Gretchen Whitmer is going to run for president, and I actually wonder, because she has a somewhat more moderate record as governor of Michigan, whether the Democrats could nominate someone like that. If you criticize Kamala Harris, maybe that's verboten within the primary electorate. I mean, this is the problem. Josh Shapiro, the most electable Democrat who's been able to win independents and even peel off some Republicans in Pennsylvania, is hated by the base of the party because he's moderate and doesn't adhere to the progressive dogma on every issue. I mean, the challenge for the Democratic Party these days is getting electable. There are moderate Democrats, Gretchen Whitmer, and, you know, you can point to a whole number of people who have more moderate, more pragmatic records. They can't win primaries. They can't appease an increasingly left-wing or progressive base. And the fact that Gretchen Whitmer, I mean, we'll see what she does, but because she went to the White House and met with Trump, and she famously was covering her face because she was actually having a productive meeting about Michigan issues with the president, that apparently it was verboten, and it actually cost her among the Democratic base back home. That's where we are. That's where the Democratic Party is right now, and that's what's going to haunt them if they can't get their act together.
Okay, a couple of things. I think Whitmer is, a much better candidate than, you know, AOC or any Bernie Sanders disciple or Crockett. Who knows? She's going to run for president. She thinks she's going to be the next senator of Texas. But a couple of things. Governor Shapiro comes out with a book and talked about Kamala Harris. And Kamala Harris says, by the way, were you ever an Israeli agent? And one of the things, which is one of the craziest questions you're ever asked, because he's Jewish? I mean, was he ever an Israeli agent? I mean, what is that
agent.
About?
A double agent.
Double agent.
I mean, it really shocked. I mean, we at Jewish Insider, we interviewed Democrats, moderates, more Democrats of the mainstream, moderate wing of the party, but they were shocked at that and spoke out. They didn't want to blame, many didn't want to finger Kamala Harris. But one of the other things about that story that Shapiro told, which is even as remarkable in my mind, is she wanted to force Shapiro to apologize for condemning anti-Semitic demonstrators at the University of Pennsylvania. She wanted, if she selected him as her running mate, she wanted him to apologize for taking on anti-Semitism in his home state. I mean, that to me, that's even more shocking. That's not just Dana Remus, her vetter. It was Kamala Harris herself that wanted Shapiro to walk back his outspoken criticism of anti-Semitism and his efforts to take it on.
Would you say
that where Kamala Harris? That's why Kamala Harris lost by the margin she did. She just had a very thin ear for where most of American people are, and she lost those swing voters badly.
Well, Josh, you're just underscoring the fact that Governor Waltz was such an attractive candidate. It was so hard. How could you pass up on all that greatness? He was almost a coach. He was almost a guy's guy. He was almost a war hero. That whole thing, loving China. I mean, you would think his background with the fraud, evidently investigations that I did not know about were raging in the background. And he's like, hey, I'd love to get Governor Shapiro, but he might be a double agent for Israel. How about the fact that you think that it's hard for a pro-Israel moderate or Democrat to win the nomination? What makes you think that?
Yeah, I mean, Tim Walz was someone who had all this baggage. I mean, and obviously sort of an indictment, I think, to some extent of the media, that the corruption that was already taking place by the time Harris picked Walz wasn't fully scrutinized and covered the way it should have been. But, I mean, Walz was a his limitations as a candidate, as a national candidate, were pretty well known. He was folksy. I think he had a good Sunday show appearance one time. And apparently Harris thought that was more important than someone who had a body of work, a very effective body of work, winning over moderates, winning over independents, having a record that was much more appealing to the broad swath of the country in Shapiro. I mean, I don't think she picked Shapiro, she would have won necessarily, but certainly Pennsylvania would have been more in play. The Midwestern states she needed to win that she lost would have been more competitive, I think. But she chose not to go in that direction. And it's, I mean, this is, again, identity politics. I mean, in the case of identity politics, in the case of Shapiro, she clearly had problems picking a proud Jewish candidate as her running mate because of the left wing and the pro-Hamas elements on the far left. I mean, that is pretty well established at this point. And look, Tim Walz, his record was pretty clear too. He's from a blue state, had a progressive record, didn't really add anything to the ticket. She needed someone who would add something to the ticket, and she ended up going with the more mediocre candidate and not someone who would actually help her win.
So, Josh, it's just crazy. The anti-Semitism in the country, the people afraid to say that they're pro-Israel. Forget about the election. It just kills me where this spot in this country. And hopefully, if you're a candidate that can't be pro-Israel because you can't win, then don't win. Right? Change the country. Do not change your mind on something that matters so much. You know, you don't have to still love Netanyahu, but I think you have to understand what Israel represents. So I want to talk about Rahm Emanuel. Here's what he said the 2026 and 8 election will be about. Cut 28.
Well, 2026 is in many ways is an election that will be defined as a referendum. 2028 is an election that will be a choice. And we have to be as good about how we're going to fight and build for the future, not just fight Donald Trump. And I think education is at the cornerstone of that.
So he believes he can run on education. My problem is, on what basis? You can't say, well, the Democrats were doing so great on education, giving in to all the teachers' unions, making sure those scores go down and kids stay out of school, making sure they understand that America has never been that great. And we have to pour most of our money into English as a second language because some of the illegal immigrants can't understand the teachers. So, I mean, what educational framework are they looking to rally around?
Well, you know what's interesting, Brian, is that Rahm Emanuel spent a lot of time in Mississippi and has touted Mississippi's education reforms that have actually led to remarkable advancements in student productivity and reading ahead of schedule and doing better math than they had in the past. And it's under a conservative governor and a conservative leadership in Mississippi. So Rahm has been spending time in a red state under conservative and Republican leadership and saying that's the model that Democrats need to embrace. But in a way, it's sort of a self-indictment for the party, at least, because he's pointing to a state that has very limited teacher union powers and one that has actually taken on conservative educational reforms to actually get those effective results in a state that has always historically lagged behind everyone else in the country. They've made these remarkable gains. Even liberals have recognized Mississippi as a real success story. But it's the problem that Democrats have is it's because of conservative reforms and actual accountability standards and the limitation of the influence of teachers' unions. So if a Democrat wants to say, hey, we need less teachers' union influence and more reforms and more standards, like that would be that's actually something that Bill Clinton ran on. But Democrats can't do that these days because of the power of the teachers' unions and the lack of strength and leadership to actually confront some of the more problematic elements within their coalition. So it is interesting. Rahm is running on a conservative success story in Mississippi, and yet he wants the Democrats to claim credit for it. I don't know if anyone other than Rahm is going to be able to really square that circle.
Keep in mind, every time we have these conversations, I'm not against teachers. We all have teachers. Most teachers that we've had in our lives had huge impact, mostly for the positive. So it's the unions that I think squelch the teachers in particular. So we actually don't even know what a lot of these teachers' policies will be. But I guess Rahm Emanuel has a reputation of taking on unions. I've not studied him enough. Like, I think when we get closer to 28, I'll start really diving in. And I know he's better than the current Chicago mayor, but he didn't walk out of his 8 years as mayor of Chicago a big hero with a great record.
Yeah, Brian, he fought with the unions as mayor when he was mayor of Chicago. And he, you know, the Clinton policy on education was the beginning of where Democrats started to take on some of the more entrenched interests and actually try to advance reforms. I mean, George W. Bush, I think, really took that to the next level with No Child Left Behind. And he was a real champion of a lot of these type of reforms as well. But the Democratic Party under Biden got away from that. They basically catered to the unions. They catered to the more progressive activists. And that's where the party needs a leader to actually say, this is wrong, this is bad politics, and we need to put children first ahead of unions.
So, Leslie, I don't know how much you dive into New York politics, but the mayor of New York City, who is working with the governor but not endorsed her, and she endorsed him. She's desperate to get the socialist vote. Scary. And now they're doing an investigation into who these socialists are. Turns out China's got a big role with a lot of them. Fantastic. So China's helping one of the fastest growing parties in our country, a socialist party, grow in America. But I digress. It looks like Governor Hochul wants $260 billion for a budget, all time high. At which time she says, I can't raise taxes. So Mondami says, I'll back off if you just fund universal daycare, free daycare. And she said, yes. And then yesterday he comes out and goes, I want to raise taxes on corporations and rich. How does that resonate for Democrats? Does that help you get the nomination? Or does Hochul be saying, I'm not going to raise taxes, help a Democrat get a nomination or go forward?
Yeah, look, I think Hochul will get renominated. She's facing like Antonio Delgado, and you know, she has to deal with the DSA and the socialists. Yeah. She's pretty liberal herself, but it goes to show how far to the left, again, these very loud, outspoken activists, many, some of whom may be funded by China. And that's a real, by the way, that's a real threat that China and our information ecosystem and the money that's trickling into to politics that is not being vetted and not being scrutinized. I mean, that's a real, real, real problem across the board. But she's trying to hold the line for the old liberal coalition, even as she's being challenged from Mamdani further to the left, and they're trying to work together. And then you have even further left forces in the DSA. But she'll probably get renominated. I would expect her to get renominated. And she feels that the political environment is favorable enough for her to get another term. But she's a classic epitome of someone who's like a machine politician who doesn't have any kind of larger principles. She's just kind of living to survive another day and dealing with all these stakeholders, many of whom are kind of corrupt in New York City and New York State to get things through. But when you have one party governance in New York State, as generally had one party governance in recent years, you don't have a lot of competition, you don't have a lot of reforms, and you have a lot of sclerosis.
A lot going on. I know that Susie Wiles says the president's going to be focused on the economy. He's going to be appearing in Iowa. No more foreign trips leading up to the midterms. I believe this game is yet to be played. A lot of Republicans are throwing in the towel early. Would you, if you're a Republican, and think, we'll lose the House?
Yeah, well, there was a new poll from the New York Times Siena poll, which I think is a good one, which actually had a good finding, or perhaps a helpful finding for the White House, which is that the voters they're losing, they're not losing them on sort of the news of the moment, but they're losing them on the economy and the sense that the economy isn't getting better for these individuals. They're still struggling to make ends meet. And some of that is just, you know, as president, using the bully pulpit to say, hey, I feel your pain, and we're gonna, you know, the big beautiful bill is gonna do this, and my plans on making sure, you know, there's less price gouging is gonna do that. You need to communicate. You need that, and I think some of the president's advisors would be well served to keep him in the States and have him spend more time giving speeches across the country, because that is the disc. It's not necessarily the headlines we're talking about every day. The polling has shown that it's the economy. That's where he's lost ground. Worries about the state of the economy and individuals' economic situation.
Which is really why the EU trade deal blowing up would be a problem. Hopefully they can work that out. Thanks so much, Josh. Always fascinating. Great column. It's now out about Governor Spiro's memoir expressing tougher terrain for our pro-Israel Democrats amid rising party divisions. It's sad, but it's 100% right. Josh, thank you. Back in a moment.
Thanks, Brad.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I used to get nominated for everything, and then the wokeness came in, and then I was considered a conservative.
Are you bad?
Ridiculous. Oh, so I was so what I call soft canceled.
Yeah,
where you don't.
Well, I'm a Bill Clinton liberal, which is from the '90s, which is now called a Nazi.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You're a white supremacist.
So that was
Bill Maher, David Spade, and Dana Carvey.
And Dana Carvey on Bill Maher's podcast, right? Yeah, it was Bill Maher's because they have a podcast too. And Bill Maher, the one thing that Bill Maher got wrong, I didn't know this either, is the reason why Joe Rogan was not nominated as podcast in the Golden Globes, that you have to put the nomination in. He didn't want to do it. So he doesn't want an award. So that's why they picked these other podcasters. They put their name in. And so when people are out and say Joe Rogan is the most popular, why not give it to him? It's not because he voted for Trump.
You got to fill out the application.
You got to want to get win. Like, I also didn't want to win.
Exactly.
So Eric wanted to win, but and Pete wanted to win, but I didn't want to win. Allison, did you want to win?
You didn't want to walk the red carpet with the Golden Globes.
Couldn't get out there. Plus, I didn't want to use my miles.
And you look make everyone look bad.
That's true.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. It's been a real busy day. I just watched Jack Smith. I'm going in and out of some of what he said. We'll bring you some of those highlights if possible. And, you know, I haven't seen it start yet, but I think it is supposed to start. It might be an afternoon session about the CEOs of the major healthcare companies. Why is healthcare so expensive? Why did you get the subsidies? And where's that money? So they're going to have to justify it. It's going to be one of those hearings where I actually want to hear their answers, and both sides will be on the same side. Because yeah, everyone realizes healthcare costs are too high, but why? You know, why is it? Why are things so expensive? Someone gouging, someone getting rich? Well, the healthcare companies, the insurance companies seem to be getting rich. What is the reason? I want to hear their side of the story. Josh Holmes is standing by with, you know, he's co-host of Ruthless, former chief of staff to Senator Mitch McConnell, and Nate Morris, who's running for GOP nomination for the Senate in Kentucky to replace Mitch McConnell. And there's a lot of people who want that slot. So before we get to Josh, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
After that woman was shot, I think, unfortunately, well, everything's unfortunate about it, right? But one of the real problems is now ICE are villains. And now people are looking at them like murderous military people that are on the streets of our city.
I don't know. I'm not. Joe Rogan clashes with ICE, not thawing in Minneapolis, and they pick up the pace over in Maine. The story on fraud in Minneapolis moves front and center finally. And fingers begin to point at the men and women in power. I'll explain.
Number two.
2026 is in many ways is an election that will be defined as a referendum. 2028 is an election that will be a choice about how we're going to fight and build for the future.
And he wants to be the DNC nominee. That is Rahm Emanuel, a very below average mayor, campaigning in like it's 2024. That's what Susie Weil says President Trump will be doing beginning in Iowa this week. We have the latest on 26, as you just heard, and 28 from the left and the right.
Number one.
It's not entirely clear to me how it would matter practically, much difference it would make between that and what we have now. We have extensive basing rights in Greenland under a treaty reached in 1951 through NATO.
Yep, that is Britt Hume. Massive news emerging from Davos. Normally a sleepy economics meeting between the rich, the famous, and the really rich, and the really famous. It's now dominated by Donald Trump. His first mission was to quell the uproar over Greenland with a deal, then a board of peace, plus Gavin Newsom and Al Gore embarrassing themselves in the backdrop. A guy that never embarrassed himself joins us now, Josh Holmes. Josh, welcome back.
Kill me. Good to talk to you, buddy. Approachable man in radio, is that what we're calling you
right
now?
Is there a battle? Is there you want to be second? Most approachable person?
Well, I don't know. I mean, do people know how difficult you are?
No, they don't until now. And then you just spilled the video. Hey, Josh, I got to just tell you, I looked at Bloomberg today. We don't have any details of the Greenland deal, but this is what has emerged. There's changes to the 1951 treaty to guarantee U.S. military base requirements. It strengthens NATO's role in the Arctic and high north. It will include a multinational NATO command in Greenland led by us. An economic component to the be negotiated, including mining rights, which I know we want, and measures to stop Russia and China's economic and military presence in Greenland. So I imagine, do we all agree it's a no-go land for them? And the U.S. stops threatening tariffs on Europe, which sounds like a pretty good framework.
Yeah, well, the markets certainly liked it. I think that the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, has got one of the most constructive working relationships with President Trump of any world leader going all the way back to the first term. It seems as though almost nobody else knows how to handle what it is that President Trump is driving at, what his real concerns are with Greenland or almost anything else. But it started with the NATO budget and trying to increase all of that. But consistently what you see is when this gentleman sits down with President Trump, things get worked out pretty darn quickly. And of course, President Trump's primary concern was the safety and security of the Arctic region, and Greenland included. And it seems like they're on a path to fix all of that.
So listen to some of the anger that came out yesterday, and tell me what you think. It begins with Mark Carney of Canada, goes to Macron, back to Carney, and more Carney. This is his moment to shine with his backwards country with almost no military that sold their soul to China. But I digress. Cut 12.
But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited.
We do prefer respect to bullies. We do prefer science to plotism. And we do prefer rule of law to brutality.
Argue the middle powers must act together, because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
Right now we are talking about a situation about the world order. Respect for national territorial integrity. Respect for international law.
But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination.
I mean, a lot of them seem to have walked that back. The EU is going to decide whether they're going to keep the EU deal in place. I'm sure they will. I think they will. What are your thoughts about us being Donald Trump and America being ripped like that?
Yeah, look, what they want is for America to be subordinate in every possible way. They want to take advantage economically of the American people as they have for 80 years in a way where the American consumer and the American worker is entirely punished by whatever it is that they levy on us. And then we turn around and have to be the world's policeman every time they get into any sort of trouble anywhere. They want to rely on the strength of America, both in our markets and our military, but they don't want to give anything up for it. And there's been president after president for generations who sort of didn't want to ruffle the feathers of anybody. They'd rather have a good quote-unquote relationship where they read each other's talking points rather than do anything about it. And I give President Trump a lot of credit. Look, it's not easy, and of course it's going to make markets nervous and world leaders nervous, but at the end of the day, you do get a better deal for the American people, and I think these people they're obviously pissed about it because it comes out of their hide a little bit.
I love this, and I know you've seen this, but it's worth having our audience share this. Scott Bessent opens up on Gavin Newsom. He's putting on a sideshow in the background. Cut 18.
The California governor calls you smug. Are you smug?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very, very ironic that, you know, Governor Newsom, who strikes me as Patrick Bateman meets Sparkle Beach Ken, may be the only Californian who knows less about economics than Kamala Harris. He's here this week with his billionaire sugar daddy, Alex Soros, and Davos is a perfect place for a man who, when everyone else was on lockdown, when he was having people arrested for going to church, he was having $1,000 a night meals at the French Laundry, and I'm sure the California people won't forget that.
Wow. How great is that?
Listen, Bessent is a badass. Kill me. This guy, not only does he know what he's talking about in terms of the economics, I think consistently in this administration, he's the most powerful spokesperson they have for what they're trying to do. But he's tough, man. You don't want to come at him with anything.
I mean, he hit Elon Musk. He knocked him in, he knocked him in the hall, remember?
I think there are like two or three cabinet officials who've taken a knuckle sandwich from Bessent.
Right.
I mean, this guy's tough, and he shows it time and time again. I mean, there he is on the world stage, and somebody asked him about a slight. Well, I mean, he's coming back with an absolute cannonball.
Right.
And he just destroyed Gavin Newsom.
I want you to hear what Newsom said back. Cut 19.
The Treasury Secretary talked about a Barbie doll. It was as if he was reading a diary and had just broken up with someone. I mean, that was the Secretary of Treasury using valuable time yesterday on the world stage.
So I guess that's his comeback.
I mean, no laughs, right? It's just like the state audience. right? Newsom. Also, I love that Newsom has this like faux masculinity thing going. Oh. Like every time he wants to show that he's tough, he's like, oh, it's a Barbie doll. He tries to have this like masculine performance of what it. And meanwhile, he is just an utter failure in every regard. And, you know, I hope the guy runs for president. I know Democrats think that he's like, you know, a good face for him. But that the fraud that is Gavin Newsom will be exposed on a national stage, and he richly, richly deserves it.
Well, the thing is, he's going to get cut up by Democrats first before Republicans get him. And I don't know how he survives that, because if I'm running against him, I do a deep background check like you used to do, Josh. I mean, if Senator McConnell had tough races. So you got to find out what the vulnerability is. And I mean, there is so much out there. Then see Democrats, maybe eight on a stage. And if they think he belongs in the center square, it's going to be open season. And I don't think he could smile and giggle his way out of that. But I think that's, you know, pretty clear. The other thing is, did you hear these reports about Al Gore sighing and heckling Lutnick while he's there? I mean, because we're not buying into his green scam, which is on tape. The world should have ended 10 years ago by now. The world has a fever.
I was shocked that Al Gore was still around.
I know.
I thought maybe he followed his own prophecy and the world would be over and he'd be done by now.
No, he's making too much money, Josh. He made a ton of money off all this.
No. Yeah, when you sell a scam like that, you gotta cash in while you can. And of course, no better place to do that than Davos, where you've got a bunch of gullible world leaders that'll follow his lead into economic damnation for the entire globe.
Right. So when we look at right now, I've been looking at all these experts, and you're one of them, that have come out and basically think the House is lost so far. And the president says, I'm going to run like I'm on. We heard Susie Wiles yesterday that she says he's going to run like he's on the ticket, and it starts in Iowa this week. I just think there's so much of the game to be played.
Totally.
That how can you possibly call it either way now? Even if they said Republicans were up 4 in the generic poll, I'd be like, so? This is so early, but you're so experienced. I remember Paul Ryan looked at this thing 2 years out and said, I'm not going to be speaker anymore, but I'll just finish out the strain. I thought, what did he say? Like, what am I missing? Why do people so fatalistic about this?
Well, you have the historical backdrop of any party in power, particularly when you've got, you know, all three branches of elected government, that you typically don't do very well in your first midterm. And that's pretty uniform over the last 100 plus years. So, and part of that is because your midterm elections is a different turnout model. And the one struggle that we've had in the era of Trump is he's got a huge base of voters that show up when his name's on the ballot and not so much in the midterms or when his name's not on the ballot. And that's a real challenge that Republicans are going to have to confront. I mean, they're going to have to reverse a trend that followed in 2018 and 2022. In a very real way. I think it can be done. To your point, there is a ton that can come out that we can deal with environmentally. If the if the economy is performing, obviously that is a good sign for Republicans. I think there's a lot of things to hang your hat on to suggest the infrastructure was put in place last year for a real economic triumph of this administration. That certainly helps.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, there's things that happen that aren't predictable. For example, Josh, as smart as you are, I never remember you last year saying, whoever gets Greenland will win the election. the whole thing's caught me by surprise. But I love this. The socialists on the left and the rock star who just got embraced and they fawned over him on The View. He's getting other Democrats upset by saying things like this. Cut 32.
I'll say it again. I continue to believe that now is the time to increase taxes on the most profitable corporations that do business in New York and the wealthiest residents that call this city home, so that they pay their fair share, so that we can create a city that delivers for all of us. What we are talking about here is New Yorkers who make $1 million a year or more increasing their personal income taxes by 2%. I spoke to one New Yorker just the other day who identified themselves as making more than $1 million. They said, is it true you want to increase my taxes? I said, yes.
Great. So right on that, baby. Go for it.
I'm glad you brought this up, Killamy, because I think that it ties into our previous conversation about what the midterms look like. You know, over the last 6 to 8 months, every Democrat pundit in America has been trying to get out from underneath the Mamdani deal. We're not a bunch of socialists. That's not the new face of the Democratic Party, despite the fact that the policies all basically echo what he's saying there from every segment of the economy. And then they're like, no, 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 the new faces are Abigail Spanberger, moderate governor from Virginia, or Mickey Sherrill, moderate from New Jersey. Like, this is what the Democratic Party is going to run on. Okay, so what do? They're there for 24 hours. Both of those governors start attacking ICE. They inform their state law enforcement they can no longer participate with federal law enforcement, with criminal illegals, people who are convicted of rape, pedophilia, murder. They're no longer participating in any of this. And then you saw a litany of the economic agenda that they are wrapping their heads around. I guess my point is this. There is no such thing as a moderate Democrat anymore.
Yeah.
Kill me. There just isn't, because it doesn't matter what they say or how they present. When they govern, there's not a dime's worth of difference between Abigail Spanberger and what you just heard from Mamdani.
Yeah, looking to undo everything Governor Youngkin did. When do we see the next episode of Ruthless?
Well, we got one up today, and you'll get another one tomorrow. I mean, we're working hard. Not as hard as Kilmeade.
Right.
But we're working pretty darn hard. We got to get the content out there. We have Tom Homan on the program today.
Nice.
Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Agriculture, on the program. We have a lot of good chats. And some yucks. You know how we like to laugh.
I know. But the biggest story is what? With Sunday at 10 o'clock, you're going to be on One Nation. That's where you're saving your best stuff for.
Well, of course. You want to. I mean, these are all hierarchical in terms
yes.
of how you hold back a little bit of talent,
if you don't mind.
Just for the big stuff.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hold back on your podcast for my show. That's all I ask, Josh. That's not too
we
much.
We seek to please. We seek to please.
And thanks for dressing up too. I mean, I get so I get the dress down, Josh.
Do you wake up in the suit?
Yes.
Tell me.
Yes.
Yeah, you like so
it's
open
a zip
your eyes
on right up the back. Right. Brett Baer calls, you put on a suit, you get some makeup on the way. Not with me. Grab my cap. Same hair as yesterday.
I just feel so comfortable.
Yeah.
I just feel
well,
so
that's
comfortable
good. Maybe
you.
It's a compliment. Josh, thanks so much. He's co-host of Ruthless Podcast. Josh Holmes, thanks so much. Back in a moment.
You're the man. Thanks.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There's one thing I heard you say yesterday and today. You are not absolutely sure that the Europeans would come to the rescue of the U.S. if you will be attacked. Let me tell you, they will. And they did in Afghanistan, as you know, for every American who paid the ultimate, for every two Americans who paid the ultimate price, there was one soldier from another NATO country who did not come back to his family. From the Netherlands, from Denmark, particularly, from other countries. So you can be assured, absolutely, if ever the U.S. will be under attack, your allies will be with you. Absolutely, there's absolute guarantee. I really want to tell you this because this is important. It pains me if you think it is not. And under your leadership, this alliance is stronger than ever.
And it's true. They added two countries. They're spending more money. But the people that have bought most of the American equipment as they bulked up has been Denmark. And there's one other country, Taiwan, since with everyone, they're not a member of NATO, Taiwan, but those are our allies that are starting to take responsibility for themselves. It looks like Zelensky has just left Davos or left a meeting. After meeting with Trump, he criticized the European allies for not doing more to help him out. So he's a little upset. He knows not to get upset at Trump, but he wants more missile defense. And I totally understand it because all the Russians are doing is aiming for his infrastructure and aiming for his energy. Guess what he's doing? He's aiming for theirs. And they got some pretty lethal drones doing some damage that Vladimir Putin doesn't want to talk about. But today on the Ukraine front, we have Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff going up to meet with Vladimir Putin directly today. I'm just so glad it's two people, because Steve Witkoff smoking cigars with Vladimir Putin without an interpreter from America, I got a problem with. I'm sure you do too. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, I want to see you in person on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day. History, Liberty, and Laughs, America 250. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets, and you can watch it on Fox Nation.
show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, we're just monitoring what's going on with Jack Smith. He's testifying now, getting his butt kissed by Democrats, and Republicans are skewering him the best they can. And he just looks so disappointed he wasn't able to put Donald Trump in jail. What a shame. Joining us now is Nate Morris, running for GOP nomination for the Senate in Kentucky to replace Mitch McConnell. He's got some tough sledding to do. Daniel Cameron, popular attorney general, did not win last time and run for governor. And Andy Barr is also running, but he got a big shot in the arm yesterday. Welcome back, Nate, because Elon Musk is in your corner, right?
That's right, Brian. We're so enthusiastic and grateful. Elon Musk, as reported, donated $10 million to a super PAC that would be helping our campaign. We had a fantastic meeting with Elon, and I think he got excited about the way that we've been talking about our senior senator and contrasting Mitch McConnell's record. And I think he also saw someone in the race that's an outsider, a business guy, an entrepreneur, and somebody that can go to Washington and shake it up and bring the kind of change we need in D.C.
So when's your primary?
May 19th.
All right, so you got 3 months to make some gains and separate yourself. But as you know, people think, well, Kentucky's a red state. Well, you got a Democratic governor. What did Andy Beshear do to win over Kentuckians, and what can you learn from that, if anything?
Well, I think it's a reflection of how poorly Daniel Cameron performed as a gubernatorial candidate. He lost by almost 6 points in a state that Donald Trump carried by 30 points. And that's why, again, I think we've got to have an outsider. We've got to have a business guy. These career politicians like Daniel Cameron and Andy Barr, these are the folks that let down our country. These are the folks that run our country off a cliff. And President Trump has proven that we've got to have job creators, business people, people that don't need the job and don't need the money. And I'm in this race to fight, and we're going to win come May 19th.
How would you be different from Mitch McConnell, who has been leadership for decades?
I mean, Brian, how much time do you have? I mean, we could go on and on for hours. I think the biggest thing is, you know, Mitch McConnell's been in that seat for over 40 years. He's been on every side of every issue. And I think most alarmingly, he stabbed our president in the back over and over again and continues to thwart his agenda. And we've got to have somebody that's going to stand with President Trump 100%, have the president's back, and get rid of things like the filibuster. You know, one of the things that I think is preventing things like the SAVE Act from happening is we've got people like Mitch McConnell that will not get rid of the filibuster. And the Senate is not some museum. It's not some gentleman's place. We know the Democrats, the moment that they take back power, they're going to get rid of the filibuster and they're going to jam all this stuff that's going to ruin our country. And we got to move so quickly to enact President Trump's agenda. Yeah. And we've got to get rid of things like the filibuster.
But aren't you concerned that they're just going to, if they take power, and eventually Democrats will always take power, just like Republicans will take it back, it'll be head snapping change. Everything will be undone immediately. That act that you just talked about, the Voter Integrity Act, the SAVE Act, is going to be changed right back. Unless you have the filibuster. Without Joe Manchin, without Sinema, you would have had two more states. You would have probably got rid of the Electoral College.
I mean, Brian, we got to get while the getting's good. We got the opportunity to get this stuff passed, to get it done immediately. President Trump has called for an end to the filibuster for good reason. We may not have another opportunity like this again. And the Democrats have already told us they're going to do this. They're going to do this regardless of what we do, Brian. So that's why we've got to get so tough. We've got to act now while we have the political capital. We have the winds at our back. And we have the mandate to do this from the American people. And we've got to let these rhino Republicans get out of the way so we can act change and we can get rid of the filibuster and get done what President Trump wants.
All right, so May 19th will be the primary. We're speaking with Nate Morris, running for GOP nomination for the Senate. So do you believe you're going to get Donald Trump's endorsement?
You know, Brian, we're going to fight hard every day. We're fighting for every inch here in Kentucky. You know, I'm a business guy. I'm not a career politician. Never been in politics before. So I'm introducing myself to the people of Kentucky every day, shaking as many hands, going to as many places as we can, and trying to engage folks to show how we're going to be the right senator. And I believe that we would be so fortunate to earn the president's endorsement. I believe we're the most MAGA candidate in the race. We're with the president 100%, especially on things like the filibuster, especially on things like immigration. And we have not contradicted ourselves like our opponents. You know, my opponents, you know, blame him for January 6th. They've done everything they can to stand with people like Mitch McConnell. And I think ultimately we would be so honored to earn the president's endorsement.
So Governor Gretchen Whitmer is probably going to run for president, too. She was pretty honest in saying there's a little bit problem with the Democratic messaging. Cut 33.
Democrats are a big tent. We want everyone to be successful. It's not picking and choosing. It's not a zero-sum game where I only win if you lose. Everyone can get ahead, and that's got to be our mindset, and that's why I'm a Democrat. Sometimes maybe our message is too obtuse for people, and we have to really have those interactions that where people feel like, yeah, you matter too.
Wait a second. There might be too obtuse for people? I don't even know what their argument is.
Brian, I tell you, I think it's really simple. I think, you know, my friend Charlie Kirk, who I'm so proud that we were Charlie's final endorsement before the tragedy that happened in September. You know, we used to talk about this all the time. This is not about Democrat versus Republican anymore. This is good versus evil. And it's really clear. If you want to move the country forward, if you want to save America, if you want to provide prosperity and the American dream, there's one way to do that. And that's with the Republican Party, and that's with President Trump's leadership. And that's why we're going to fight so hard when we get to the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I guess we're going to see what's going to happen. So the president's going to start. We know J.T. Vance is going to go to Ohio. Today's first going to go to Minneapolis. And the president goes to Iowa, where a lot of the numbers don't look good, even in Iowa, for Joni Ernst's seat. What kind of political headwinds do you think Republicans are facing in the midterms, besides history?
Well, you know, this is something that a trend that happens with every midterm. But I believe President Trump is going to fight so hard. I mean, Susie Wiles has been very clear about this. The president's going to campaign just like he did in 24. And we know when the president's out on the stump, there's nobody that can beat him. And I believe that's why we're going to have a great midterm. He's going to go full bore to make sure that we get this done for the House, for the Senate, and we can continue the MAGA agenda for another 2 years to finish out his presidency. So I have all the faith in the world that the tides are going to turn and we're going to be victorious come this fall.
I'm watching the unemployment still historically low at around 4 or 5%. We're watching the GDP 4.4, 4.5%. They expect it to be 4.3. These are huge numbers, right? Steady on the unemployment and huge on the growth. So if I was to tell you, Nate, with your economic background, why do working class and middle class feel as though they are still, America is still not as affordable as it was? What would you do to make their reality more palatable and maybe get their vote?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, Brian, as you know, we've been cleaning up a mess from Joe Biden and all the inflation that he put on this country. And thank goodness for President Trump to stop this inflation, to get our economy moving again. But, you know, we're still cleaning up a lot of his mess. And I think working class folks like my family, you know, Brian, 19 of my family members worked in an auto plant. I come from generations of auto workers that build trucks and cars for a living. And when things like NAFTA and things like China entering the WTO, it was people like my family that got hurt. And I see their pain every day that they're having to fight against all this inertia that was put on us from Joe Biden. But I think it's getting control of our border, which we've done. It's making sure every illegal goes back. I believe immigration impacts every economic aspect of America today. The people that are employing illegals, the people that are overrunning our healthcare system, overrunning education. So I think the president has been so fantastic in sealing the border. Now we got to make sure all these illegals go back. And Brian, I know we talked about this the last time I was here. That's why I've called for a full moratorium on any new immigration until every illegal goes back. We're absolutely full as a country. And they've all got to go back where they came from.
All right. Nate Morris, best of luck. He's going to be in a primary up May 19th against Daniel Cameron and Andy Barr. And Nate Morris is, as you just heard, endorsed by Elon Musk as well as Charlie Kirk. Nate, thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. So busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Signed an executive order to bring back mental institutions and insane asylums. We're going to have to bring them back. Hate to build those suckers. Democrats in New York, they took them down, and the people live on the streets now. That's why you have a lot of the people in California and other places, they live on the streets. They took the mental institutions down.
So the president of the United States was talking wistfully about mental institutions, and because they were so poorly run in the 70s, they basically banned them. And now we're dealing with so much crime from people who are mentally ill on the streets. He wants to bring them back, not to warehouse people, but to be able to deal with people. It's not fair to them either. And a lot of the homeless population has mental, has some type of mental illness on the street. A lot of it stems from maybe drug use that you can rehab people from. The other thing is you got to protect them and their family members. How many times with mental abuse you've seen this thing with Rob Reiner's son? Guy's in schizophrenic medication. Maybe he should have been institutionalized, but where? Against his will. So the president wants that conversation to come back. And I thought it's another executive order, more of saying, I'm going to do a lot in my first year. He's doing a ton. So they are doing something very unique in Washington. We know about the lockout that took place in the fall, right? And they weren't able to get things done in regular order. So they wanted to extend the negotiation. Instead, they shut it down. And then when they brought it back, they said, January 30th is a new shutdown. Do you know what they're doing now? They're actually passing things on regular order. I think they got 5 or 6 appropriations bills done. They got to get up to 12, but they are making great progress. Why? Because a lot of this stuff's not controversial. You know, you sit there with Democrats and Republicans, not everything is controversial. They're actually working together on a lot of things, and the majority is so slight in the House, especially just one person advantage when the breakup of these committees. But the other thing that Democrats are trying to do, they're not going to pass the Homeland Security portion of the funding if they don't have reforms or abolish ICE. One Democrat is standing up and saying, I am not buying into that. It's the one that Donald Trump pardoned, Congressman Henry Cuellar. Listen to him with Bill Malusian, Cut 35.
How do you plan to vote on the DHS funding bill?
I will be supporting, but every member has to vote their district.
What pushed you to yes?
Some of the oversight provisions that we put. Well, I mean, nobody pushed me. We got there. We negotiated. It's not everything we wanted. We wanted more oversight. But look, Democrats don't control the House. We don't control the Senate or the White House. But we were able to add some oversight over Homeland.
So, look, he's very strong on the border. He can't believe the border's sealed. Donald Trump pardoned him. He was being targeted and primaried by the Democratic Party. One thing Donald Trump did is if it wasn't for Henry Cuellar, that would be a Republican seat. But he's got such a good reputation in the area. Democrats tried to destroy him and his wife. So when Donald Trump pardoned him, he thought he might be a Republican, but he did not do that. Here's a Democrat saying why she's going to vote no. Let's not fund Homeland Security. Cut 37. This is Sarah McBride.
I think Americans across the political spectrum are disgusted by what they have been seeing from masked ICE agents around the country, including particularly what we saw in Minneapolis. I cannot in good conscience vote for legislation that funds the Department of Homeland Security as they continue to engage in what is essentially paramilitary activity on American streets.
No, they have to move without cops. They move a lot different when they have support, like in New Orleans, because Louisiana supported them. But they got to move quick, and they got to go with great numbers because no cops can help. And they certainly don't provide the investigation and the limitations by the law. They're federal troops, an operation that is laudable. So Chief Mark Brulee is also a critic. He's with Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. So he says he has a problem. He has a problem, by the way, ICE is operating. Cut 40.
In Brooklyn Park, one particular officer that shared her story with me was stopped as she passed ICE going down the roadway. When they boxed her in, they demanded her paperwork, of which she's a U.S. citizen and clearly would not have any paperwork. When she became concerned about the rhetoric and the way she was being treated, she pulled out her phone in an attempt to record the incident. The phone was knocked out of her hands, prevented her from recording it. The officer had their guns drawn during this interaction, and after the officer became so concerned, they were forced to identify themselves as a Brooklyn Park police officer in hopes of slowing the incident and de-escalating the incident down. The agents then immediately left after hearing this, making no other comments, no other apologies, just got in their vehicles and left.
So that's an incident. I'll go by what he said. I'd love to hear the pushback on that. But if you see what they do and the horrible people they're picking up, knowing that they let 350 hardened criminals out of prison, Waltz and this guy Jacob Fry, and now it's up to ICE to round them up in 0-degree temperatures while being harassed by Minnesotans getting paid to do just that on the premise they're pleasing their mayor and governor, who are poor excuses for a human being. Here's Jason Hauser, though. He's on MS Now, former ICE chief of staff, Cup 42.
I must say, I've talked to dozens, if not hundreds, of state and local law enforcement, as well as keep in touch, you know, all the time with my former colleagues. Any officer, former or current, that I hear from, the sort of how this is being carried out, no one sees as sort of in the public safety interest. And we're starting to see the outcomes of that in our community. It is starting to personally affect not just migrants, but our communities, because of whether it's political opportunism or whether it's sort of quota arrest targets, whether it's just sort of driving fear as sort of a deterrent to kind of stop individuals from seeking asylum or coming to our country in our immigration system. ICE was not built to oversee 14 million.
But can I ask you about the humans?
Immigration docket.
So they have, let me see, they've arrested 3,000 in the last 3 weeks, illegal immigrant criminals, and 10,000 overall in Minneapolis alone. Now they're fanning out to Maine, where I think the population is, maybe they told me 15%. Most of the rest of the stuff is woods. But they got this huge corruption issue and huge illegal immigrant issue, mostly from, drumroll please, Somalia. So you want to ridicule the people tasked with trying to gather up 9 million people, and there might be some people on the side that get scooped up in it, but ultimately, if they're here legally, they haven't committed a crime, they'll be kicked right back where they belong. That is just what happens. And if you want to be a sanctuary city, then you got to have to deal with three times as many ICE and border agents than everybody else. It's pretty clear. When it comes to Minneapolis, the fraud is huge. There's 74 people have been convicted, 85 charged. I think 97% are Somalis. The one white woman who's doing jail time for stealing millions, got a Porsche and got all these pictures of her, the lavish stuff. She's actually speaking to our own Alexis McAdams, at which time she's saying that there's no way the mayor and governor didn't know all about this as the money cascaded in. They knew all about it, and the attorney general. And guess who set up the whole food program that was so abused? Congressman Ilhan Omar. Omar. I don't know if she knew about it, but how could she not? If you actually shepherd in a program and it's got your name on it and your signature underneath it and you are the author of it, and then it becomes the most abusive program in Minnesota history, how could you not be blamed? Or how could you allow that to happen? Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.